So I want to introduce you to Joanna Macy, who Kay and I were really very fortunate to get to know and to do a workshop with when we lived in the Bay Area in the 1980s. And at that time, she was very active in what she called the nuclear guardianship work. She was already very concerned about what was going on with the impact of nuclear waste in the environment. And the thing about Macy that was very extraordinary in our experience was that she was grounded, that what she was doing workshops. She wasn't just going around and talking to people about issues or, you know, let's get together and demonstrate, but she was doing workshops with people about how to connect emotionally in a wholesome way, if you can believe in such a thing, with some of the issues that were going on in the environment, and to learn about those things, and traveling all over the world to do this sort of thing. And we were really just incredibly impacted by her and what she was doing, and she's still at it. She's pretty elderly, but she's still at it. And this particular book that I'm passing, that I've been particularly interested in is full of practical applications that have come out of her workshops. But I'm particularly interested in her chapter on what she used to call deep time. And the chapter is entitled Deep Time, but that's what it is. But I want to back up and I want to talk a little bit about Macy in context. So she, and because that's important. So she comes to Buddhism as an academic. She studied at Syracuse with Houston Smith. But she also became very interested in general systems theory. So she looks at the environmental issues, and she looks at Buddhism through a very complex perspective. Now, the way she teaches about it in her workshops, you won't hear about general systems theory. But if you listen sort of underneath what she has to say or what she has to write, you'll see that it's going on. And I wanted to start there because it's important context, and it's a different way of thinking about Buddhism. And in the framework of general systems, for me, a nice metaphor to even explain what means general systems, because it's a pretty highfalutin word, is to think about our bodies, and then we have all these organs in our bodies that function as a system. You know, the heart, the kidneys, the liver, all these things work together. Even though there's a larger organism, which is the whole, there are all these individual parts within it, which are the organs. And so general systems theory would look at the way in which all the parts relate to each other and relate to the whole and how the whole relates to the parts. And one of the things that this view holds is that it's not just, as we might say, that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, but there are what they call emergent properties in the whole. And for example, if you go back to thinking about the body and you think about if you are like the heart and the person sitting next to you is like the kidneys and the person on the other side of you is like the liver, you know, in the body, it certainly doesn't make any sense for the heart to say, I'm what matters and nothing else matters and I'm going to get all the nutrients and you're not. Because kidney failure will kill you, liver failure will kill you, and heart failure will kill you. It doesn't really make any difference. Everything has to be nurtured and everything has to work together. And when it all works together, there is this entity, which we call a body, but it does have qualities that are different than any of the individual parts. And I think we understand that if we're looking at a body system, on the one hand, there are issues associated with each individual part. So what makes a heart healthy might be different than what makes kidneys healthy. I mean, drinking lots of water might be good for making kidneys healthy. I'm not so sure whether that makes any difference to your heart or not. exercise would be good for your heart. Does it really make that much difference for your kidneys? I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe it does or maybe it doesn't. But my point is that the individual elements, or the individual parts, might have different requirements and needs that all need to be met for the larger whole to work. And then the larger whole, in the way it relates to the parts, has unique features. So if you're thinking about a system, you're thinking about individual bits, how the individual bits relate to each other, how the bits or the parts relate to the whole, how the whole relates to the parts. And you're also thinking about everything has different qualities at the different levels. The system qualities and the individual qualities are different. So why does this matter? Well, if you shift the metaphor now to a more Buddhist context, where Buddhists are talking about the problems of the self and as an individual, and how does the self relate to others? How does the self relate to the larger whole? You see where the metaphor connects. Now, from the point of view of environment, though, if you now start to think the larger whole as environment, and each of us as individuals in that, then you see where I'm going with this way of thinking about things. Now, one of the things that occurred to me is a quotation from Einstein, which I looked up, and I hope I'm not misquoting him. He said, "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them." You know, I mean, if you think about it, yeah, that's kind of logical. Okay, that's kind of logical. Okay, but now let's put it in a Buddhist context. I mean, in a Buddhist context, okay, so we're looking at environmental problems, but let's step down to the point of view of the individual. In that context, the problems that an individual looks at, traditionally described as dukkha or suffering or things aren't working out real well, or I want to be happy and I'm not, that's the basic problems humans have, is a result of something called avidya or ignorance, right? So if we think about Einstein and we think about avidya, then, you know, we got into this mess that we're in as individuals and as a collectivity and there's a certain level of thinking that's associated with that. It's called avidya, understanding independence or selfhood where there is not autonomous, independent selfhood. So the solution to the problem isn't going to really happen at the level of avidya. And that sort of throws a monkey wrench into the Buddhist way of talking about things, because when you look at generally at the Buddhist way of talking about things, they look at that problem, the problem of avidya and individuals dealing with things and solving things. So where does that go? Well, it goes to Macy talking about deep time. So this is my segue into deep time. Again, I'll do a little context before I get into it too far. When Buddhists think about time, they, not surprisingly, tend to think about time differently than most Americans think about time. For one thing, when we think about time, we always think of past, present, and future. And it's not that Buddhists don't talk about this, but they do point out, for example, Nagarjuna, the great philosopher, points out that we don't actually, on the whole, know what we're talking about when we talk about time or when we talk about past, present, or future, because when we talk about present, we think here it is. And when we talk about past, we say there it is and it's gone. And we usually point to the left because we're English speakers. If we were Muslims, we point to the right when we said time, which is interesting in itself. It says something about our notions of time. And if we're Chinese, we point up there because their writing starts up. Well, it used to. Ancient Chinese writing started up and went down. Now it doesn't do that. It's much more like ours. Anyway, so future's over there to the right, past is over the left, and present is here. But as Nagarjuna pointed out, the only way we understand what the past is by knowing that it's not the present or the future. The only way we know what the future is by knowing it's not the present or the past. And therefore, the only way we know what the present is by knowing it's not the past or the future. There's a problem here, which is that the three of them define each other mutually. There's no external basis for definition. They're completely relative to each other. So each is meaningless without the other, which is to say we don't actually know what any of them mean, if you really get down to it, if we think deeply about it. So that's the thumbnail sketch of the Buddhist view of time. Generally speaking, that's laid out in about 5,000 pages, but that's the thumbnail sketch. So when Macy, though, talks about deep time, she's actually operating on that foundation, but within the context of general systems. Because what she encourages people to do, and now so this gets to the point, what she encourages people to do is to think about the situation of the present in the context of the future and the past, but to open to what future and past might be in a new kind of a way. For example, as she points out in her chapter on time in this book, we don't tend to really think about the people of the past or the people of the future in much of anything we do in the present. She gives an example of going to Los Alamos in New Mexico, probably Los Alamos, one of the nuclear sites in New Mexico. And she's meeting with somebody who's talking about the storage of nuclear waste. And he's being very proud about the way they've stored the nuclear waste. He says, these containers will last 100 years. Well, so what is the half-life of radioactive iodine? How many million years is it? I don't remember. It's a lot. So she, being, you know, a nice person, says, 100 years, and then what? And she said, then he looked at her like, well, what do you mean, and then what? Does that matter? Well, it matters to the people who are around 100 years from now, but nobody's thinking about people who are around 100 years from now. She says, you know, in your behaviors, in your understanding, you can think about the future within the context of the present. And similarly, the past. She says, you know, we don't think about ancestors. She says, in the Asian world, the ancestors are around all the time, and you ask them for help. They're there, you know. So when you begin thinking in the context of deep time, you begin thinking about what's happening in the present, and you think about it not just about where it's coming from, but where it's going to use that common in English language. But then you can also think really deeply about it, differently about it. You can think not just about how the present depends upon the past, but here's one for you. You can think about how the present depends on the future. I mean, there's no fundamental reason why the beings that are alive in the future can't communicate to us in the past any more than the beings in the past communicate to us in the future. We don't think they do. It doesn't mean they don't. It really doesn't mean they don't. It just means we don't think they do. I mean, sometimes, for example, I'll be doing something, and I will pick up something that's going to go in the trash, and I'll look at it, and I'll think, is somebody going to be looking at this in the future? Yeah, I think so. I can see that. Kay gave an example that really struck me. One of our main teachers, Tara Tilku, came to do a talk at Kennedy University, where I was at the time, and I think it was 1987 or 88, something like that. And so we video recorded him, and I happened to be looking at this because I just transferred it to DVD. I just transferred the videotape to DVD so we'd have it off in the future. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't seen it for a long time, and Kay watched as we went through the transfer process because we had to play it on the television while we were doing the recording. And she said, you know, he just kept looking at the camera. And then he would kind of look away, and he would have these unusual expressions, and it was sort of like, did he know we were going to be looking at him 25 years later? You know? What was going on? You know? So, I mean, he did his talk, and he didn't just do his talk for the people who were there, although he definitely did, because he was very engaged with everybody who was there. He was engaged with the people of the future who were going to be looking at that. Well, that was obviously us, but it might be other people. Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen to that DVD? Right? We don't know. So, as Macy would say, we can do what we do in the present with an understanding that there are beings in the future who care about what we're doing in the present, and we can be in relationship with them. And she actually invites people to imagine that they've received letters from the future about things. Okay. Now, that's very interesting. I mean, you know, I like to imagine somebody picking up a piece of trash saying, you stupid, what were you doing? You know, didn't you know this was going to be around? But then that creates some interesting problems for us, because now we're back to systems. We can't live without eating. And for most of us, that means going to Safeway. And there's nothing to do about the fact if you go to Safeway, you get packaging with your food. And I look at the amount of trash that goes out of this house, and I'm appalled. Because I take it out. that seems to be all over the country, the guy thing is to take the trash out. Mars, Venus, right? I take the trash out. And, but I don't know what to do about it. You know, what do you do about it? There doesn't seem to be anything to do about it because we're caught in the larger system, you know. Now, that gets back to where I started. Individuals, systems, and the issues that exist on the level of individuals and the issues that that exist on the level of systems. And somehow, when we think about personal responsibility in the context of Buddhism, we tend to think about me. That's okay if we're thinking about personal responsibility. But the problems, to go back to Einstein, are not going to be resolved only at that level. Somehow they're going to be resolved at the systemic level. And I can't say I know what that means. It might mean political action, you know. It means all kinds of possibilities. I don't know where the solutions are. I'm just saying that we need to think really differently about these kinds of issues. But that doesn't mean we don't need to think about the way we've been thinking about things. Because just as the heart needs attention, the kidneys need attention, the lungs need attention, and the whole body needs attention, the kind of attention they need and the concerns that exist and all those levels are all different, but they're all necessary, and the relationship between them is all necessary. If I want to have a healthy heart, I need to have a mind that doesn't stress my heart out when I go to work. And, you know, that has nothing to do with how much water I drink, you know, whether I'm taking, you know, fish oil and whatever else my heart wants. It's something else entirely. That's a solution that exists at a systemic level. And I only have limits to what I can do on that level because I work in a system that has its own characteristics. I relate to it in a certain way, but it has its own characteristics. How do you deal with those things? So it's pretty complicated, and I'm not proposing solutions. I'm just looking at context. Macy, however, does have ways of dealing with these things and dealing with these questions. There is another feature of deep time, though, that I want to turn to. And Macy touches it briefly, but she doesn't go into it really deeply. One of the things that she does really well is she addresses the potential despair and paralytic quality these concerns can have. You know, when you start facing environmental problems squarely, it's possible to become paralyzed. It's possible to become anesthetized. It's possible to go into deep despair because the problems are huge. So she's made a lot of effort to find ways to help people engage with these problems in honest ways, but without despairing and trying to think positively at the same time. So she's written about what she calls the Great Turning, because she believes that we're moving into another age where people are going to wake up to what's going on, and hopefully there will be people after the waking up, that the world's not going to say, we don't want this little human virus around, and goodbye, you know. But she mentions somebody called Thomas Berry, who I don't know that very many people have heard of, but maybe people have heard of Thomas Berry. Father Thomas Berry, who is, I think he's Jesuit, has written about something called The New Story. And it's because he's a Christian, The New Story is in Christian context. And as he's pointed out, you know, we had in the former time, we had this story of creation that gave us a sense of purpose and place in the world, as Christians anyway, if we were Christians. And then along came evolution, and that story got blown away. He said, but you know, really, we live in a world where science is a new religion, and the new story that we need is the story of evolution as potentially something positive. That's the new creation myth, is science. And he writes about it really extensively. So Berry's writing also had a big influence on me, because what I came to see is if you think about the new story in the context of deep time and the Buddhist sense of time, I think one of the conclusions that you can come to is about something we call the bodhisattva path in Buddhism, which is bodhisattvas are beings who choose to evolve over time. And they do so by cultivating themselves, but they do so by cultivating themselves for the benefit of the larger whole. That's their intention. Not merely to cultivate themselves as themselves, which they do, because like a heart in the larger system, each individual requires care. So they care for themselves. It's not like their altruism is not like a version of a type of Christian altruism, which is I have to suffer so you can get what you need. It's not like I give up so you get. It's more like I evolve so everybody can evolve. So the Bodhisattva path is, from a Buddhist point of view, the new story, or a new story, which is people engaged in living in the world in a way which is positive and evolutionary, caring about themselves, caring about the community, caring about the larger whole, in ways which benefit all of the above with wisdom, which is to say, understanding the needs and the transformation of the individual as having certain characteristics, the needs and the transformation of the larger whole as having certain characteristics, and the relationship between them having certain characteristics. They're like beings that understand general systems theory, if you will, and can apply it in some sort of way. But the other thing about the Bodhisattva path is I think mostly people tend to think about the Bodhisattva path in very limited terms. It's like in the terms of understanding I, me, mine, my community. I think that if you think about the Bodhisattva path in the larger sense of deep time and in the sense of the new story, there is some large evolutionary process that's going on in the world, and it's using human beings in some way that we don't understand. And I think one of the things Macy is saying, although she doesn't quite phrase it this way, is it might be worth having faith that it knows what's going on. Certainly, if you read the poetry of Gary Snyder, he's really clear about this. He says, the world knows what's going on. It may not always take care of human beings, but it takes care of itself, and it's going somewhere, and it's doing something. And we have some responsibility in the context of that. But in the end, whether we matter or not, the world will do what it needs to do, and it will get on. But, you know, if we think about what we're doing in the context of the Bodhisattva path and the new story as being part of the evolutionary process, it doesn't mean that there isn't going to be difficulty ahead, but it may be like the difficulty of birth. A lot of kicking and screaming and wailing and gunk, you know, and bills, large bills, but something gets born, you know, usually something gets born. You pay the bills and you clean up the mess and get on with it. All the mamas know that. It's true. The male perspective. It's true. So there's a bit of my introduction to Macy. We'll come back to more Macy, but I just wanted to give some overview.